Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Law as a tool for social change is the subject of this edition of Radio Curious, and it's also a reason why I decided to become an attorney. Our guest, Neil Proto, now a veteran Washington, D.C. attorney, was a law student in the early 1970s in Washington, D.C., and one of several law students in a group called SCRAP, Students Challenging Regulatory Agency Procedures, which sued the Interstate Commerce Commission of the United States and the nation's railroads for what they believed was a violation of NEPA, the then recently enacted National Environmental Protection Act. The regulations, which they successfully challenged, discouraged the movement of materials that could be recycled and encouraged the movement of raw materials. The federal court issued an injunction and ordered an environmental impact report to be prepared, and in the end, the regulations were overturned. The story is told in Neil Proto's book, To a High Court, the tumult and choices that led to United States of America versus SCRAP. For the past 35 years, Neil Proto has been practicing and teaching law in the nation's capital. In this conversation, recorded in early February 2006, we discuss the SCRAP lawsuit, the importance of citizen involvement in the use of law as a tool for social change, and how court rulings in recent decades have made this involvement more difficult. Neil Proto, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. I'm glad to be here.
The lawsuit that you were involved in when you were a law student, the SCRAP lawsuit, took on the ICC and the railroads. Tell us a little bit about it, the importance of it then, and then we'll get to the importance of it now.
Well, at the time, I was a law student at George Washington University, and I was intent on doing as practical a thing as I could while I was in law school, and so were my friends and colleagues. And we formed a group, Students Challenging Regulatory Agency Procedures. The acronym is SCRAP. And after we investigated the harmful consequences of railroad freight rates, the consequences that were harmful had to do with the environment. That is, that the rates discouraged the movement of materials you could recycle and encouraged the movement of raw materials, materials that would have to be extracted out of the ground or severed from the earth in some fashion. And the result was great harm to the environment and the accumulation of waste and all the harm that that would cause for cities, for the environment, for individuals. And so we finally decided to file this lawsuit against the United States of America, the Interstate Commerce Commission, and the nation's railroads. The legal questions were quite consequential. This was the first case that ever reached the Supreme Court of the United States involving the National Environmental Policy Act, which is today quite commonly used, oftentimes quite ineffectually, I'm sorry to say, by the government. But the most fundamental legal issue was standing to sue. That is, whether or not, under the Constitution of the United States, the five of us, five law students, had the right of access to the judiciary, had standing to sue in order to vindicate our rights and the public interest against wrongdoing committed by both the government of the United States and the nation's railroads.
Let's bring that standing to sue to a current issue. I've lectured a number of times on the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if we look at the issue where bookstores or libraries are subject to a subpoena to say who has bought what and told that if you tell the buyer, you will be violating the law, who would have the standing to sue there?
Well, you would hope that a librarian might, that a university or a city municipal system that's being coerced into providing that access might. You would certainly would assume that a user of the system might have standing to sue and therefore have judicial access. But if the government holds true to form, the United States will do everything it can to try to deny standing to anyone challenging that program.
There are some cases that say you have to have been charged with a crime before you can bring the constitutional right as a defense, obviously to a criminal charge, trying to diminish the standing. And I would think then that if someone is going to be told that they would be charged with a crime, if they reveal this information, they're not going to say it. They're going to be more likely to be quiet.
I think that that's probably correct, and it tells you something as well about the challenge that whether you're a plaintiff or you're a defendant in a criminal case, the challenge you have to determine whether to be vigilant enough about protecting your rights, how hard it is to make those choices, especially if you're a defendant because you're not quite certain what else you're opening yourself up to. And you also know that on the other side is the United States of America and the power that it can bring to bear in prosecuting you or making your life just flat out difficult.
Going back to the scrap lawsuit that you organized as a law student in 1971, you were able to confront that power. You were able to establish a new precedent on standing.
Yes, Barry, we were. And I think back in 1971 and 72, and I know you'll appreciate this from your own experience, there was respect for the law, but there was not reverence. We were prepared to challenge wrongdoing, including as students. And although it took great thought on our part and lots of care, we found ourselves not apprehensive, not unwilling to engage in that challenge. There also was at the time, and you'll appreciate this as well, federal judiciary in the lower courts and in the Supreme Court that held government to a high standard of duty and was not apprehensive or uneasy about taking on hard cases because they believed they had a duty to decide hard cases. It's different today. It's more difficult to get judges in order to do that. But at that time, we were prepared to engage the United States and the Interstate Commerce Commission and the nation's railroads.
Well, what happened in that decision?
Because the United States was so insistent on claiming that we did not have standing to sue, in the lower federal courts, we won on that issue. United States Court of Appeals Judge J. Skelly Wright, who was actually quite famous here in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country for a variety of reasons, concluded that we did have standing to sue and wrote an opinion for himself and two other judges. When the case went to the Supreme Court of the United States, we won 5-3. Justice Powell, who was on the court at the time, did not sit. But we won 5-3 that we did have standing to sue. And as a consequence, the Interstate Commerce Commission had to prepare the environmental impact statement that we claimed was necessary, and they did it actually over the objections of the railroad industry.
And the end result?
The end result was a change in the freight rate structure, and it was the beginning, in cultural terms in the United States, of a recognition of the value and the importance of recycling. And the various impediments to recycling that were occurring on one level by virtue of these freight rates I was describing. If you were in the steel manufacturing business, you had a choice. You could either use scrap iron and steel, or you could use iron ore. And because of the way the freight rates were structured, you were taking that iron ore out of the ground and using it to make steel while the scrap iron and steel lay waste. And that was the same case for things like timber and paper. You could find a whole bunch of analogs that went through the system, but really culturally in America, a lot changed after that. So now, today, we're much more sensitive about how we use natural resources than we certainly were during that time period, and far more conscious of the value and importance of recycling.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Neil Proto, a Washington, D.C. attorney who has more than 35 years of being involved in hands-on, people-oriented litigation in the nation's capital. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Neil, you said that the federal judiciary in the early 70s held the government to a higher standard, and that's more difficult today. Why the change?
It really is the consequence of a series of appointments beginning with William Rehnquist and Justice Powell, eventually Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and then you can see it as well, actually even more pervasively, on the lower federal courts and the United States Courts of Appeals, the emergence of this conservative effort that really views litigation, views the filing of lawsuits, views standing to sue as almost offensive, as almost an intrusion upon the freedom of the government and corporate interest to basically make the kinds of decisions they want and not have them subject to judicial scrutiny.
Well, you mentioned that in a New York Law Journal article from September of 2005, and particularly in relationship to John Roberts, the new Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. But if the courts don't decide these kinds of issues, then there's no check on administrative or executive decisions. What checks and balances are there?
Well, that is really a dilemma, because as long as the Congress of the United States is not prepared to engage in either serious, regular oversight of what the executive branch is doing, and they have not been, what you're really confronted with is an executive branch that can pretty much do what it wants to do, and it can do it with the comfort of knowing that they're not going to get checked or balanced by another branch of the government. And certainly not by the judiciary. As I describe it in the article I wrote on then-Judge Roberts and his nomination process, I think that attitude is very problematic. You want judges and justices who are going to insist government preserve their duty, the integrity of their duty, and their obligations to the public. And that is happening less and less frequently in this country.
We're about to be confronted with the issues now in the winter of 2006. Of President Bush perhaps directing the opening of people's mail, eavesdropping on phone calls. Where do you see this going?
There's really two things I think you need to follow that would be useful. One, of course, is whether or not the legislative branch of government, the Senate and the Congress, are prepared to assert their own integrity and their own duty under the Constitution to enact laws that everyone must comply with, including the President of the United States. But the other development that needs to be watched is the judicial one, and that is there have already been three lawsuits filed, one against the National Security Agency, one against the President, and a third against AT&T, challenging basically AT&T's complicity in the NSA program. And in all three of those cases, it's brought by journalists and some lawyers, researchers and writers who frequently deal with individuals and people in the Middle East, Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran. The AT&T one, of course, is brought by consumers of AT&T. But the questions in all of those will be standing to sue. And it's quite uncertain to me whether or not those individuals can withstand the power of the executive branch to preserve as much of its own authority as it can by trying to knock those people out of this litigation.
Well, then does that leave us with someone who would learn after the fact that their conversations have been listened to?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's absolutely correct. And if there's one thing that we've experienced in the country, and you don't need to be much of a historian to appreciate this, that back in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, certainly during the Nixon administration, while J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI, this kind of abuse of private conversations, communications, whether it was a telephone, mail, today, email, was quite prevalent in scary and disquieting ways in this country, in part because in time, and you can already see the beginning of this in this administration, whatever the intention was of the executive branch, however high purpose they may have had, in the end, they had political motivations and ideological motivations that they found themselves intruding for all the wrong reasons into people's lives.
Where does this come from?
Well, it's a mentality. It's an attitude. There is a very interesting quotation from Justice Brandeis, the case that he had in the 1930s, and I remember reading it in law school and being so taken by it. Brandeis is trying to come to grips with sort of unchecked executive power. But he says he's just concerned about the insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning, but without understanding. And you can see it today, I believe, in the executive branch. I think it's pretty pervasive. People who have lots of zeal, but I'm not sure they understand fully the seriousness of the consequences of the harm they're doing on the integrity of the American Constitution and precisely those kinds of principles that distinguish us from the rest of the world.
Justice Louis Brandeis talks about the purpose that the law has to serve the people. And that resonated with you as a young law student.
It certainly did. I was very taken by Justice Brandeis, actually before he became a justice, that is, when he was a lawyer. I thought he really set a model or an example for what a lawyer could do to serve a public purpose and the public interest. As it turned out, of course, he was especially involved in examinations and analysis of the horrific way the nation's railroads were being abused. He did it early in his career, and it was something I read about and was very moved by how compelling his sense of duty was as a lawyer. As you know, he was referred to as the people's lawyer throughout his career and then finally was appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Neil Proto, let's talk for a moment about lawyers. Why do we get such a bad rap?
I know when I was in law school and writing my book, I was impressed by those lawyers who followed the Brandeis model, even when they were in private practice. And at the same time, I found a lot of lawyers in private practice, and I'm sorry to say I see them in government now today, who are so committed to these corporate interests, to this compelling need to, it's not just to make money. I wouldn't fault anyone for wanting to have a decent life and a reasonably good income if they can get it, but there's something in the value structure that gets played out when you do that that really denigrates what we all learned as law students, which is the importance of the law in affecting people's daily lives and the manner in which the law preserves dignity, fairness, freedom, those kinds of values that are so essential to us, but somehow in the process of actually getting out there and doing it, seems to get lost. I see it most frequently in either lawyers who do lots of corporate work, and sometimes unwittingly, not just in a harsh way or a deliberate way, as well as those in government who just get it precisely what Justice Brandeis was talking about, this men of zeal. And I don't mean men just as men. Today it's women as well. And there's something that gets lost in there in terms of what the purpose of the law really is.
So then if you were counseling people who are considering going to law school or people who are in law school now, what would you tell them?
Barry, I would tell them, first and foremost, that the law is something to be respected, but it is not something to be revered. It serves a purpose.
It's a tool.
It absolutely is a tool. It is to be used to accomplish a purpose. And if that requires you to challenge authority or challenge those in power, that's precisely what your duty ought to be. And you should be as persistent about that as you need to be until you attain the goal that you think is valuable and important and serves a public purpose.
From your historical perspective, having been an attorney in Washington, D.C. for the past 35 years, what do you see as becoming the new challenges that will face the United States, all of our citizenry, in the coming years?
Well, I think first and foremost, we're going to have to confront a presidency that has been very aggressive with respect to diminishing individual rights and civil liberties. I think that really is a serious problem. And second of all, as you know, and we've just talked about it, the elevation of Chief Judge Justice Roberts and Justice Alito means that we're going to have a progressively conservative Supreme Court, or they're going to try and move it as much as they can in that direction for some time. And that, too, gives me pause with respect to, on the one hand, individual liberties and civil rights. And I use those terms very broadly, Barry. I'm not just talking about racial discrimination, for example, in the context of civil rights, but also discrimination related against veterans. It could be related against those with disabilities. I mean, there are many examples nowadays of that kind of discrimination in the country, let alone the sort of emerging discrimination, which is sort of reflective of an earlier era in the United States, and that is against those who look different, speak different, have a different political point of view. All right, I'm concerned about those. On the other hand, the other side of that coin is this powerful deference, and you could see it in Chief Justice Roberts' experiences. You can certainly see it absolutely in Judge Alito's experiences before he was elevated. You can see it in Justice Scalia's attitude, this deference to government. it just emerges so frequently in the way they think about the rights of the public or in individual rights, environmental laws, consumer laws, deference to the government, and almost invariably that means deference to corporate interests.
Then what is the individual person to do? What would you counsel be done in terms of protecting personal rights and individual liberties in the coming years?
I think they need to continue to insist, however frustrating it might be at times, that the judiciary has precisely the obligation they have had historically to protect those rights. And whether it means filing lawsuits that, even if you lose on the question of standing to sue, or you lose on the merits, you still need to be vigilant and persistent about that. And, of course, you should turn to the legislative branch of government to insist that they preserve their own integrity. It is absolutely essential that people remain vigilant, and more so now than has been the case in a good 20 years in the United States.
Attorney Neil Proto, let's talk about the concept of corporate personhood.
Mm-hmm.
Under our system of laws, a corporation has the same legal rights and authorities as do you and I and the rest of the people in the country. Do you think that's fair and just?
Barry, I don't. I'm a little bit familiar with the history of how this evolved. And it evolved at a time when corporate interests were really being protected by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was quite amenable to trying to give them rights and due process rights and equal protection rights like we have as individuals. It was an unfortunate circumstance that gave rise to it, and the Supreme Court has never really been able to move away from that. I appreciate why corporations should have rights to sue and be sued under certain circumstances. But to compare them to the rights of individuals with respect to due process or individual liberties is odd and, in my mind, inappropriate and ought to be revisited by the Supreme Court. It's also had other consequences. Corporate interests in this country, you can certainly see it today in Washington, D.C., they have influence and the ability to affect decision-making in executive branch agencies in ways that public, really, day-to-day, has no imagination about the power that's being played out that is really very reflective of what corporations want, but not necessarily what serves a public purpose. It happens every day here. During the scrap controversy, what we saw was the nation's railroads being run and led by individuals who could have cared less about the fate of passenger service or how to serve communities or how to preserve the railroad stations or anything like that. All they were doing was siphoning money off into amusement parks, executive jet services, things that you would find stunning or quite stunning at the time, although they've gotten quite commonplace when you look at part of what Enron was trying to do. But you could see this insidious corporate influence, especially at the Interstate Commerce Commission, and the criticism of the commission for actually allowing some of this to occur in such a pervasive way. And you'll recall that during much of the late 60s and into the 70s, railroad stations in many parts of the United States, I mean, I can say this with certainty because I'm originally from New Haven, Connecticut, the Eastern Seaboard, they were shut down. These lovely railroad stations and communities were harmed. People were laid off by that kind of conduct. So the more power corporations have, the more they're recognized as having the same rights as individuals, the more you could see over the decades how that has played out in other forms and in other ways that are serious and harmful.
How would you see as a way to challenge that?
Well, it's interesting to me. I think it would really require the right kind of lawsuit. I don't know if it could be initiated by an individual or a group, but you'd have to try and find the right setting and really, with a whole series of amicus curiae briefs, try to force the court to reexamine that issue.
Well, how about on a state level to seek to withdraw the corporate charter, saying that they're violating certain aspects of a state's constitution where it was chartered?
Well, that would be, I think that would be an excellent idea. I think that would be a very engaging and important lawsuit. There was a time, and if I can, I'd like to come back to Justice Brandeis for a moment, and I actually quote a little bit of this in one chapter in the book. Justice Brandeis was very skeptical of the corporate charter. And he said this in a case in a dissenting opinion, very uneasy about the power that the state was about to confer on a corporation and what abuse that would cause. And that is a question, and his dissent was eloquent about it, that really could be revisited on a state level. It could be revisited legislatively as well as in courts of law. And if you could find the right sort of the right set of facts and issues, and you appreciate what I'm saying as a lawyer, I think it would be worthy of a serious effort.
Well, Neil Proto, attorney in Washington, D.C., author of To a High Court, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I can, and actually I'm rereading it, if you don't mind me diverting a bit from your question. It's a book called The Prince of Our Disorder. It's about T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. It's written by a Dr. Mack. And I'm finding the rereading of it after, for me personally, a good 20 years worth of research and learning about T.E. Lawrence, to be a very interesting read about leadership, about the importance of being sensitive to the culture and the settings around you, and about challenging the orthodoxy, about taking on powers and influence that seem big and huge, but it can be done. And in Lawrence's case, it certainly was problematic for him personally over time, but I'm very taken by the seriousness of purpose and the insistency he had of trying, in that case, to forge a new nation in a culture that he had worked very hard to understand. I don't mean to overstate his role in that, but it was certainly an important one, and I'm sort of taken by his persistence and his effort to do it.
Neil Proto, author of To a High Court, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Barry, thank you very much for having me.
Neil Proto is an attorney in Washington, D.C., and the author of To a High Court, The Tumult and Choices That Led to United States of America versus Scrap. The book he recommends is The Prince of Our Disorder, The Life of T.E. Lawrence by John E. Mack. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.